Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport. Offering service through Silver Airways with daily service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Orlando with connections to the Bahamas. Fares and information available online at silverairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates, offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to Florida's $71.8 billion hospitality and tourism industry, whose members provide over 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at FRLA.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
When it comes to health care, the Florida House is hoping a bundled package of related health bills will help the medicine go down easier in the Senate chamber down the hall.
I think the bad outweighs the good on this bill. And I'm sorry to see so many bills clammed together.
Also tonight, as the pension reform effort continues in both the House and Senate, opposition to changing the state's retirement system keeps growing.
Young people need to have both options, and we need to keep this. It's one of the soundest retirement plans in the world, not only in the nation, but in the world.
We'll also talk about puppy mills, plastic bag regulations, and a sunny demonstration at the Florida Capitol. The 2014 Florida lawmaking session continued on this Thursday, April 10th. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. The Florida House is cobbling together several different health-related bills in the hope the combined proposal will sway the Senate to vote for them. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the new combined proposal still doesn't sway some in the originating chamber.
Florida lawmakers started off this legislative session with attempts to lay out ground rules for telemedicine, trauma centers, and what's become an annual turf battle between different groups of health practitioners. But the House and Senate have different perspectives on all of these issues, so the House is combining them into a single piece of legislation. In legislative terms, the bundling of related bills is sometimes called a train. The goal of a train bill is to make it harder to reject part of the proposal without the rest collapsing. But there's always the danger the train runs off the rails, taking its new passengers with it. As Hallandale Beach Democratic Representative Joe Gibbons argued in the House Regulatory Affairs Committee Thursday, it becomes a judgment call.
So this approach is a good approach. Now, when I looked at this bill initially, I said, man, they took some good stuff and put it in with some bad stuff and mixed it in with some good stuff. And then you say, well, does the good outweigh the bad? In this case, the good does outweigh the bad.
I think the bad outweighs the good on this bill.
But not all lawmakers will support a train bill, as Stewart Republican Representative Gail Harrell's comments point out. Take the issue of telemedicine, one of the dominant back-and-forth topics so far this session. The House plan would let out-of-state doctors see Florida patients if those physicians first register with the state. The Senate wants those out-of-state docs to have a license to practice in Florida. Harrell wanted that provision added into the House bill, but it failed. And Naples Republican Representative Matt Hudson then took a swipe at opponents like Harrell.
For those that say we have too much in this bill that's not good over what is good, you know what? I'm sorry, but it's time to actually evolve a little bit and recognize that the Internet's not a fad and that perhaps 49 other states aren't wrong.
When it comes to trauma centers, the House is seeking to protect three privately owned facilities in Pasco, Marion, and Bay counties. Those centers are in the middle of a fight with large nonprofit hospitals, which say the trauma centers drain resources and staff rather than improve access to care. The House placed a moratorium on new facilities in a bid to win support from the Senate, which is also considering a trauma center moratorium proposal. However, the chambers remain divided over a bid by advanced registered nurse practitioners who want the ability to prescribe basic medications and see patients without the supervision of doctors. This plan has been so far a no-go in the Senate, and it's a non-starter for some in the House, Harrell and Doc Renouard. Talking to reporters prior to the bills being combined, House Speaker Will Weatherford said the goal is to give all the measures a boost in the Senate.
Some of these issues are related to each other, and sometimes it's easier to send one omnibus package over to the Senate as opposed to a bunch of individual bills.
In the Senate, the proposals remain separated. But before the House train bill can switch tracks and head over to the Senate, it must first pass the full House, and not everyone is prepared to lay down and be run over by the Health Care Express. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A pension reform proposal is now heading to the Florida House floor, while its Senate companion just cleared its first committee. As Sasha Cordner reports, while both the now scaled back bills have their differences, they also have an equal amount of opposition from public employees and most Democrats stacked against them.
Trilby Republican Senator Wilton Simpson's bill has gone through several changes. And Thursday, during the Senate Government Oversight and Accountability Committee, it was no different. The bill no longer tries to create a third retirement option for new employees coming into the Florida retirement system or create a special exemption for special risk employees like firefighters or police officers. Instead, it's now similar to a proposal that died in the Senate last year, also authored by Simpson, and he says all employees still get to choose.
Under this plan, newly hired rank-and-file employees, including teachers, law enforcement officers, firefighters, corrections personnel, and emergency workers who have never previously participated in the state retirement system will continue to have a choice between pension and investment.
The bill now looks a lot like the House bill in that elected officials and senior management no longer can join the defined benefit plan known as the traditional pension plan and must instead join the only other retirement option, the 401k-style plan known as the investment plan. Included in that are judges, which some Republicans didn't like. That includes Fleming Island Senator Rob Bradley.
It's a separate, co-equal branch of government, and it's appropriate to not have them included.
School superintendents could be included in that as well, which concerned Tallahassee Senator Bill Monford. But the panel's chair and fellow Democrat Jeremy Ring urged caution.
Because eventually everyone's going to come with a carve-out. You know, I'm not saying it's not legitimate. I just think we want to be a little careful as we start looking, you know, at each group, because every group's going to come to us with that.
The measure also makes the investment plan the new default for newly hired public employees, and they have 8 months to decide if they want to stay or move to the pension plan. The current default is the pension plan. Those who decide to opt into the pension plan would have to stay in the plan for 10 years in order to get their benefits. The current vesting period is 8 years in the pension plan. It remains 1 year for the investment plan. All employees still retain the right to switch to either plan for one time only. And to further incentivize employees to stay in the investment plan, the bill lowers the contribution employees have to pay toward their retirement to 2%. Currently, those in both retirement plans contribute 3%. Under Simpson's bill, only those in the pension plan will continue to pay the 3%. Mike Fulis with the Florida Shares Association says that appeal to recent hires of the 401k-style plan will hurt all the people that are already in the system.
Right now, what we're doing to the new employees is we're saying, look, if you go into the investment plan, you're going to pay a less contribution. You're only going to have to contribute 2%. And after 1 year, you're already vested into that program. Whereas in the defined benefit program, you're 10 years down the road before you're vested. So by having them default into that investment program, it is more appealing to them. And what we're saying is that's going to deplete the funds that are going into the normal retirement system, which ultimately will hurt the people that are in the system.
But Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons, a bill supporter, says the measure is already appealing for employees who may not believe they're going to stay in their employment for that long.
The fact of it is if I get into the investment plan, the amount that is put in vests immediately, right, or within a short period of time. And then what happens is if 5 years from now I decide that I don't want to be a police officer, want to try something else, That money is mine.
The measure is also supported by Americans for Prosperity and the Florida Chamber of Commerce, who say it's great for Florida taxpayers. But some unions point to how the legislature is using numbers from last year as part of the study, and the actuarial data could change. Still, the Senate measure passed 7-2 with most Democrats opposed. Senator Jeremy Ring, the panel's chair, was the only Democrat to vote in favor of the bill, his measure aiming to address some of the unintended consequences of the state's so-called double-dipping law is now tucked into Simpson's bill. The law was designed to stop thousands from collecting a paycheck and retirement benefits at the same time, but in doing so, about 38,000 people who left their jobs after the law was enacted took their plan with them and later tried to work again for the state during a specified time period, found they could no longer re-enroll in the Florida retirement system or receive the benefits owed. There may also be another amendment added to the bill that looks at exempting judges from having the investment plan retirement option as their only choice. Meanwhile, the House proposal, which encountered the same opposition from Democrats and public employee unions, passed its only committee Thursday. It now heads to the floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Not all of the action in Tallahassee occurred in the Florida legislature. The state Supreme Court today rejected an appeal from death row inmate Robert Eugene Hendricks, who's slated to be executed April 23rd for the 1990 murders of a Lake County husband and wife. Hendricks argued that his trial was fraught with substantive and procedural errors that denied him a fair and impartial trial, according to the court. But in a unanimous ruling, justices upheld a circuit judge's decision to reject Hendricks' arguments. Hendricks, now 47, was convicted of the shooting and stabbing deaths of Elmer Scott Jr. and Michelle Scott. The Supreme Court ruling said Elmer Scott was Hendricks' cousin. Hendricks went to the Scott's home because he feared his cousin would testify against him in an unrelated case. Also, in a murder case that drew widespread attention, the Florida Supreme Court today turned down an appeal by a death row inmate who was convicted of killing an Escambia County couple during a 2009 home invasion robbery. Leonard Patrick Gonzalez Jr. and four other men entered the home of Bird and Melanie Billings with plans to steal a safe that the men thought contained $13 million. Bird and Melanie Billings died after each being shot multiple times. A circuit judge in 2011 sentenced Gonzalez to death in both murders. He challenged the convictions and sentences in his appeal to the Supreme Court, raising numerous arguments. Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers are working to crack down on so-called puppy mills.
Since the USDA is now regulating commercial breeders who sell puppies sight unseen over the internet, flea markets are one of the last unregulated marketplaces for questionable puppy sellers.
A bill lifting the ban on local plastic bag regulations will not be passing this year.
You know, this bill probably won't see the light of day this session, but I do think it's the kind of discussion that we need to have.
And we'll witness a solar energy rally at the Capitol, during which advocates called for producing more power from sunshine in the Sunshine State.
Florida has the best solar resource of any state east of the Mississippi River.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too, on the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
Animal breeders say pet sales at flea markets are the only remaining unregulated pet sales in Florida. But Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers say they've come up with a plan to ensure the state's four-legged friends are perfectly protected.
Dog lover and occasional breeder Elizabeth Whetstone says she asks herself a number of questions before ever selling a pup. When is the puppy ready to leave its mother? Is it healthy and does it have a healthy family history? What home is it heading to? But she says those people selling pets at flea markets aren't considering those factors.
When puppies are sold in environments such as flea markets, this is very telling on many levels. There's a common term we use for these people. We call them backyard breeders and puppy mills. These people breed dogs indiscriminately.
Whetstone says that can mean breeding puppies with health problems as well as personality disorders.
Let's start with temperament. Because of the indiscriminate breeding practices that apply to these folks, they have little knowledge of the importance of temperament behind the dogs they breed. They breed whatever is available to them and often ask people on the street if their dogs are available for breeding. This has happened to me when I've had my own dogs out in public.
Whetstone says in order to maintain high standards, she researches the history of dogs to breed and carefully selects homes for her puppies, adding she's bred just 4 litters in more than 10 years. She makes her money instead through a dog training and pet sitting business. But Florida Humane Society Director Kate McFall says often the practices of bad breeders are encouraged, since the more animals a breeder sells, the more money that person can make. Instead of responsible breeding, she says those breeders are focused on volume. That, she says, feeds a cycle that's bad for the animals and for the consumers.
After the money has changed hands at the flea market, most consumers don't realize the transaction is over. There's no recourse for that purchaser, who will most likely be faced with large veterinary bills. There's zero consumer protection for that customer, that flea market buyer.
McFall says many of the puppies sold at flea markets have not been properly vaccinated. That can mean they're carrying diseases or parasites the puppy could pass on to other animals or to humans. And Whetstone says beyond ensuring the puppy gets proper medical attention before leaving for its new home, she says many other breeders she knows maintain some responsibility for the animal throughout its life. For example, she'll take back any dog that's come from her business, no matter its age, in order to keep it out of an animal shelter. Hollywood Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel is sponsoring a bill to outlaw the sale of pets at flea markets. It's a move McFall and Whetstone both support. But Bradenton Republican Senator Bill Galvano worries the measure could have a negative impact on reputable dog breeders.
My question is, if you have a licensed, reputable dog dealer that simply leases a booth at a flea market, would that then be prohibited by this bill?
Sobel's legislative assistant, who presented the bill Thursday, says a situation such as that is not likely to arise, as dealers agree a flea market is no place for puppies. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Acknowledging the ticking clock winding down in the 2014 legislative session, the sponsor of a bill allowing local governments to regulate plastic bag use has withdrawn his measure from consideration. As Jessica Palumbo tells us, Florida cities currently are prohibited from making rules discouraging the use of plastic carryout bags, as cities in other states have done.
First, some plastic bag history. A few years back, the legislature put in place a ban on local plastic bag regulations while the state studied rules in other places. In cities like Washington, D.C., stores and restaurants must charge a fee for every plastic bag customers carry away. Although Florida's study was completed more than 4 years ago, local governments' hands are still tied when it comes to restricting plastic bag use. And Osceola County Commissioner Brandon Arrington says he wishes he could.
I think any movement in that direction, or any first step, to be honest with you, would be a welcome sign from local government.
Arrington says for one thing, there's the litter issue. He cringes thinking of a chain link fence he regularly drives past that's covered in bags from a nearby shopping center. Besides being unsightly, he says the bags cost local governments that must clean them out of storm drains.
You'd be amazed at how often a pipe can get clogged by a plastic bag that has drifted into a culvert, had grass help grow around, and it will later become the preventative measure, or the measure that creates localized flooding.
The bill, sponsored by Miami Senator Dwight Bullard, would have allowed cities and counties to pass carryout bag rules if they wanted to. But to keep uniformity for statewide chain stores, the bill said they'd all have to use the same rule. No plastic bags allowed, and a 10-cent charge for every paper bag, with the goal of encouraging reusable bag use. Unloading a cart full of plastic bags in front of a Tallahassee Public store recently, Joel Leone says he owns several of the reusable ones, but never remembers them.
Yeah, I would remember if I got charged 10 cents every time I came here.
He says that's a great idea for reducing customers' carbon footprint. Across the parking lot, Alex Maychek is putting plastic bags full of groceries in her car. She says she also supports the idea of outlawing plastic and charging for paper.
Yeah, I mean, like 20 or 30 cents, I don't, because paper bags are usually bigger anyway. So I feel like having to pay like an extra 30 cents shouldn't really make a difference.
But walking past Maychek's car, Rondell Bennett and Patrick Ferris say they don't see the point of the legislation.
Like, what does plastic bags actually do to people?
Can we do something like important, like legalize weed or something? I really feel like that will help way more than paper bags. It will help. Like, it's people out there with cataracts and y'all worrying about bags.
And customer James Stanford says he's not convinced the legislation would reduce litter.
I use plastic bags for trash cans at my house, to be honest with you. Yeah. So I feel like outlawing plastic bags or doing that, it would be bad, because we can use plastic bags for other reasons, other resources other than what we use for now.
That argument was echoed by Samantha Padgett, a Florida Retail Federation lawyer who testified against the bill Thursday. She says stopping people from getting plastic bags at a grocery store will mean they'll just have to buy them to line their garbage pails and scoop their pets' waste. But environmental groups testified the plastic bag recycling rate is so abysmal that they're much more likely to end up littering nature. But the bag debate will have to continue next year after Bullard withdrew the bill, knowing its House companion measure hasn't moved.
We talk about the notion of impact of water bodies all the time, especially in this committee. But we don't talk enough about the human impact on those water bodies and how we can do a better job of mitigating that impact.
Kissimmee Democratic Senator Darren Soto offered Bullard a suggestion for next time. Take out the 10-cent paper bag charge and instead offer stores a tax credit to stop offering plastic ones. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Ronald J. Eben gives us a look ahead to Friday's action at the Florida Capitol.
The House Judiciary Committee meets from 8 till 12 Friday. On the long agenda is the Florida Civil Rights Act that prohibits discrimination on the basis of pregnancy in employment and specified establishments. There's a bill that requires a child's parent or guardian, in addition to the child, to make restitution for damage or loss caused by the child's offense. It also authorizes a parent or guardian to be absolved of liability for restitution in certain cases. There's a school safety bill that authorizes a school principal to carry a concealed weapon and requires school boards to formulate policies and procedures for dealing with active shooters and hostage situations. There's a measure that prohibits employment of minors in adult theaters, requires adult theaters to verify the ages of employees, and it revises penalties for various prostitution offenses and repeals certain prostitution offenses involving minors. The Senate convenes at 9:30 Friday morning in what is expected to be an all-day session, with a long list of bills up for consideration, including a motor vehicle insurance liability bill that extends the period of time during which a policy may be canceled by the insurer. There's a bill that redefines the term telephonic sales call, prohibiting a telephone solicitor from transmitting certain text messages to a consumer if the consumer is on the no-sales solicitation call list. And that's a look at the legislative highlights for Friday, April 11th. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
There was an uprising at the Florida Capitol today, although it had nothing to do with the state's Native American residents nor the Florida State University Seminoles. Not long after the morning sun peeped over the horizon, those advocating more support for solar power followed suit. Stan Jastrzebski reports it wasn't too long before politics came shining through.
It looked and felt like spring break does in some Florida locales. Young people dancing to live music, event organizers handing out dark glasses with a sun emblem on them, and even dolphins, although the dolphins were metal and rooted to a Florida Capitol fountain. It was a pep rally for the sun, which shone brightly overhead. As if to convey the ferocity of their message, organizers even gave the assembly a slightly ominous name.
When I say solar, you say uprising. Solar!
Uprising!
Solar!
Uprising!
Solar!
Leading that chant is Stephen Smith, the director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
North Carolina has four times more solar deployed than the state of Florida, and it's a smaller state with less resource. Florida has fallen to number 18 in the last quarter of last year with installed solar.
As if to aggravate that sunburn, Debbie Dooley, a member of the Georgia Tea Party and a partner conservative environmental group called the Green Tea Coalition, took the microphone.
I bring you greetings from the Sunshine State of Georgia. That's right, the Sunshine State of Georgia. If Florida stays on the same path, they're no longer going to be known as the Sunshine State because they are trying to shut the sun out.
Dooley cast herself as an outsider in the partisan crowd waiting to hear from Democratic gubernatorial hopeful Charlie Crist. She says she likes Governor Rick Scott, but thinks perhaps he's suffering from a case of sun blindness. She says her group views solar expansion as a free market principle.
If you care about energy freedom and energy choice, join me, and I want the conservatives to join forces, and let's lead the way on energy freedom in Florida.
Speakers repeatedly pointed to the 22-story building behind them and chastised Governor Scott and the legislature for shuttering solar energy initiatives. Justin Vanderbrook, a member of the student-led group Ideas for Us, told the crowd those policies are costing the state jobs and young minds, including his own.
Hey, I want to let you know I'm proud to be the last man standing of a solar energy company that started here in Tallahassee and installed over 100 systems within a 5-mile radius of where we're standing right now. The rest of my company, they're no longer in Florida because we do not have the market that attracts their investments.
Vanderbrook is off to California next month to work for a solar firm there. While he's leaving, someone who's trying to make a comeback is Crist. While he failed to make any specific promises about how he would help Florida better capture the solar energy present in the crowd, he didn't waste the chance to cast his opponent as raining on the state's parade.
There is a cloud blocking the sun from coming in, and his name is Rick Scott. We've got to stop, Scott.
That led Stephen Smith to propose an additional qualification to become the state's chief executive.
New rule. You cannot be the governor of the Sunshine State if you do not support solar power.
Though several of the speakers alleged the state's utility companies fill the coffers of those lawmakers uncommitted to renewable energy, it is worth noting there are programs offered by those companies which incentivize solar panel installation. But it's also worth noting one from Florida Power and Light was so popular, there's a waiting list stretching into next year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Evan, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport. Offering service through Silver Airways with daily service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Orlando with connections to the Bahamas. Fares and information available online at silverairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates. Offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to Florida's $71.8 billion hospitality and tourism industry, whose members provide over 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.